That's the only place that...
Well, if it's supposed to be on a roof, or it's gonna be like that.
Yeah.
You can say that, but, you know, and then want to pay that, you know, that could be, if someone's...
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. I'm David Alkeck, the president of this organization, and I just want to welcome tonight, you know, this Dallas Philosophers Forum has been in existence 35 plus years, and one of the first, if not the first president, a president for so long, Bob Wernicke is with us. Would you step up, stand up, Bob? He was president when I started. I was just about, what, 10 or 12. Anyway, tonight we have with us Dr. Gene Hargrove. First a few little announcements. Make sure that you pay your admission fee. That, you know, we still have our expenses. Our treasurer here, David Drum, $5, and if you're a full-time student, only $2. And make sure you pay your food bill. Don't walk out. Somebody forgot last time. Yeah, please, because you'll stick us with it. And make sure you give them a little tip too. With it. They appreciate that. Any new visitors? People who have not been here before, newcomers. How did you hear about us?
Mia. I've been on the email list for years.
Oh, great. Anybody else? Okay. Well, welcome. We hope you'll come back. We have a nice program coming up, and here's a schedule coming up. Next 2 weeks, we're going to have Paul Benson talk about why Dallas, untangling the mystery of Dallas rise to prominence. And then yours truly is going to give a talk on artificial intelligence and the future of medicine March the 13th. Anyway, so tonight we have Dr. Gene Hargrove, who was born in way up north in Detroit, Michigan. Reared in St. Louis, and did his undergraduate work in University of Missouri, Columbia, where he also got his PhD. He did postdoctoral research in Vienna on Wittgenstein, and became a Rockefeller Foundation Fellow in Environmental Affairs. In 1979, he became the editor of the Journal of Environmental Ethics that you founded, right?
Yeah.
In 1981, he took the journal to the University of Georgia and then moved that to the University of North Texas, where he is presently. He's the chair of the Philosophy and Religion Studies Department.
No, I'm not anymore.
No, not that. But you started the first graduate philosophy program in environmental philosophy and ethics. I think you sort of invented that field.
Yes.
That's great. Now he's the director of the Center for Environmental Philosophy at the University of Texas, North Texas. Recent years, he has focused on problems with the teaching of environmental ethics and in ethics generally. So without any further ado, welcome Dr. Gene Hargrove.
So am I on?
You're on.
Okay. This is a talk on environmental ethics and the culture war. And the culture war, mostly it has to do with gays and transsexuals and things like that. However, and which bathroom you're allowed to go in, but basically it started in the first decade of the 19th century, and it had to do with whether or not ethics and religion should be taught in the public schools. And it's been a continuous thing, focused on that all the way through to now. And the culture war ended up being involved with my efforts to develop the field of environmental philosophy and environmental ethics. And many people, after I started the journal, eventually they started being critical and said that I had done everything wrong, and the reason that environmental ethics and environmental philosophy were not better was because I had done all the wrong things. And I have gradually realized that things went bad when Ronald Reagan became president, and which was exactly the same time that I started the journal. And so there was an effort to bring the culture war up to the level of the universities by a philosopher who got to be the head of the NEH when Reagan became president. And at exactly that time, I was attempting to do things with the NEH, and so it's been kind of downhill mostly ever after that. Although the NSF is much better and didn't go the way of the cultural war, and the NSF supported environmental ethics to a large degree, but the amount that they were willing to do it was fairly small. So anyway, environmental philosophy may be too complex to be reduced to an elementary school level in any intelligible way, but I'm convinced that in order for environmental ethics to actually work, that we probably need to start them out in first grade. And but it may be possible, even though we can't teach them any of the stuff that's been developed in my journal and in other journals that are now competing with environmental ethics, that it's we could start them off in such a way that when they grow up, they might actually care about environmental ethics. When I got to North Texas, the environmental program in biology was interested in environmental ethics, but when the students came in, they were totally shocked, and it took a number of years before people were able to adjust to it very well, and mostly the person who was started the environmental science program, named Ken Dixon, the students would say, "Why is Ken Dixon making us take this stuff?" And but then some students began saying, "You know, well, it's actually pretty good, and there's a lot of things that are worthwhile." And gradually, the environmental science students started coming in with expectations very different than they had in the beginning. But I'm going to propose that we need to start them out at first grade. Most students in North America believe that values are subjective, personal biases are arbitrary and irrational, that all values are instrumental, and that they're expressions of emotion, they're just how we feel, and they're just not facts. And that the world is or ought to be value-free. And intrinsically valuing something is stupid. In fact, I've decided that at an early age, they become inoculated against the term intrinsic value. And the only economic value is objective and worth thinking about. Now, these views are acquired at a very early age without formal teaching. Brian Norton, who's fairly close to me in some respects, but considers himself an opponent, wrote a book called Toward Unity Among Environmentalists, and he begins it by talking about how he had a debate with a girl who was probably about 4 years old on a beach about sand dollars, which are little creatures that live in the sand. And it turns out that you can dig them out of the sand and you can take them to a hobby shop dead and get it 5 cents for each one. And so he wrote about how in the world could he ever convince these, this little girl and others like her that these sand dollars were valuable in other ways and simply as something to get money for a nickel apiece in a hobby shop. He decided that he'd probably need weeks, maybe months, to even get started with her. And and by that time, he would have been arrested as a child molester. Now, the girl, she hadn't gone to school yet, but she was not taught these views. She just picked them up by something like osmosis. And this osmosis is what Michael Pogliani, in his books, The Tacit Dimension and Personal Knowledge, calls tacit knowledge, where you pick things up, but you don't learn a vocabulary for it at the same time. And he says, we know more than we can tell, and we don't know the history of this knowing. We just think that it is the way things are, and that it's a fact, basically. And these beliefs make it very difficult to teach adults much of anything about ecological values or environmental ethics. Economic value wins. Now, what is economics? Turns out that it's economics claims that it's not philosophy at all, that it's all fact. But it's a blend of utilitarianism, logical positivism, and pragmatism. And this pragmatism is Dewey pragmatism. And now utilitarianism holds that good is pleasure, and the economists call it satisfaction. Aristotle warned us that good cannot be pleasure because some people take pleasure in bad things. If it is, if good is pleasure, then there can be no moral standards. Logical positivism holds that values are expressions of emotion, that they are arbitrary and irrational, and the values are just how you feel or have been trained to feel. And pragmatism, Deweyan, I've been accused of saying bad things about William James, but I actually say nice things about William James frequently in my books. And so it's just Dewey. Dewey decided that all values are instrumental. And he did this because he read a sentence in G.E. Moore's Principia Ethica that said that good is the value something has independent of its relationship with all other things in the world. And Dewey said, nothing has any value independent of its relationship to all other things in the world. So he said that value is use, and valuing something for its own sake intrinsically is a waste of time. And he devoted all of his philosophy after that to regularly attacking intrinsic value. And even though one could say that intrinsic value was an established part of ethics for probably 3,000 years or more, he managed to wipe it out. And one can go back to Plato and the Republic, and in there, Plato has Socrates say, some things are valuable for their own sake, which means intrinsically. Some are valuable for their use, and some are valuable for both. And he decided that that the most valuable was when it was valuable for both. But we have two other philosophers, Aristotle and Kant, and they are means-ends philosophers, and so the end is supposed to be intrinsic value, and the means is instrumental value. And in this conception, it's either this or that, which erases what Plato said as both. And so anyway, these three get us all the things that I listed earlier as to why values in ethics aren't any good. Now, economics cannot help us with value education because it claims to be a scientific alternative to ethics. Milton Friedman, a fairly famous economist, wrote a book called Essays on Positive Economics, which is the application of logical positivism to economics. And he begins it by saying, if economics forgets about ought, value, and concentrates only on is, fact, then economics can be a science. And so he recommended that we forget about intrinsic value. To introduce ethics into economics introduces subjectivity and undermines the claim that economics is a science. Teaching values in elementary school in the United States is inhibited by the culture war. So the economic thing, getting rid of intrinsic value, only started at the beginning of the 20th century, but it was wrapped into a thing called the culture war. And the culture war began about 1800 with a conflict between Protestants and Catholics over the teaching of values and religion in schools. Values and religion were removed from the schools to encourage Catholics to send their children to public schools. However, Catholics and Protestants falsely believe that the value-free education is a result of an atheistic humanist conspiracy. That's one view. Another view is that it has to do with separation of church and state in the Constitution, but that idea didn't pop up until the 1960s. Which I already did that one. And the culture war has proceeded without a sense of history. For 200 years, just a second. Need to wet my throat.
Go ahead.
For 200 years, Catholics have sought to get public tax money to fund their private schools. And the answer has always been no. And the reason that it's always been no is because all the other religions were watching the Catholics to see if they succeeded. And if they had succeeded, then every religion would have wanted to have tax money returned to them. And our public schools would all be Methodist schools and Presbyterian schools and Baptist schools and so on. And every year, Catholics make the proposal, and it is rejected as if it is a new idea without any history. Culture war is an endless ahistorical debate. The proponents of the culture war hold that teaching values leads to indoctrination, and teaching values leads to moral relativism. And the reason is that first, the teacher, if they're trying to teach ethics, are attacked on the grounds that they are trying to impose their personal ethical values on their children that they're teaching. And then if they argue that they're not teaching their personal values, but that they're teaching different points of view, then they're accused of relativism and told that they're teaching that value has no meaning. No matter what they do, they get them. Now, the indoctrination charge is based on the idea that moral values are individual, not social. And the idea that teachers' values do not reflect common social or family values. The idea that values should be the responsibility of the parents only not the state. And this actually puts us into the same situation where Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle were. As Aristotle writes in the Nicomachean Ethics, although the best arrangement would be for the regulation of moral matters to be taken over and properly administrated by the community, yet inasmuch as the community neglects them, it is rightly considered the duty of each of us to help our own children and friends along the road to virtue, or at least to have the will, even though we lack the power to do so. And it goes on and he says, but instead, everybody gets their ethics from the one-eyed cyclops, the male head of the family. And it's whatever that person thinks. This is the key issue in Plato's Minnow. In the middle of the Minnow, somebody comes in and has an argument with Socrates about whether or not virtue can be taught. And Socrates tries to convince him that it's a very difficult thing and probably nobody can. So he goes through a bunch of famous people and saying, well, that's a really great father. And says, well, what are his children? What are his children like? And it turns out the children are all really a mess. And so supposedly proving it. And so then the person he's arguing with says, you know, you need to be punished for this. And so, of course, Socrates was the victim of the Greek version of indoctrination, where he was considered to be corrupting the youth with his personal ethical views, and he was killed for it. Now, in my journal, there's an article by two people from Kenya, and it's called Wilderness and the Bantu Mind. And the title is to make fun of Roderick Nash's book, Wilderness and the American Mind. And and they point out that the children in Kenya, when they first go to school, they don't like wilderness. And the idea socially in Kenya is that wilderness is a very dangerous place where you can easily get killed, you know, by lions and you name it. And the children basically reject wilderness. And in the paper, they suggest that it might be better if they started off by talking about ethics from the viewpoint of the actual social values of the society. And that would be my view as well, that you're not going to get very far if you attempt to impose values that are developed in North America or in Europe. And these values are frequently said to be imperialistic, colonizing, and totalizing. And the Western views conflict with local cultural views tacitly learned at a very early age, like the little girl in Norton's book who figured out that economics is the only type of value that's worth anything, because you can get a nickel for a sand dollar. And this is an international postmodern and ecofeminist critique. Sorry. Teaching values also leads to moral relativism. When value teaching ceased, the psychologists tried to fill the void. They stopped teaching values in the schools in the United States in 1860. And you can actually trace it out because there were books that had ethical stuff in it, and everything was gone by 1860. And after the Civil War, there was no there was no discussion about ethics except which Bible you could refer to in the schools, and so they had Bible riots occasionally, but that was about it. The psychologists accepted the idea and concept that all minds work the same. Therefore, they said, asking children to create their own values and ethics would produce a proper result without indoctrination, because you never told them anything. You just said, suppose this or that and what would happen. And this approach was further refined by defining the stages of mental and moral development, first with Piaget and then with Kohlberg. And the procedure came to be called values clarification. So you could teach ethics by asking them questions and by not using any ethical terminology of any kind. And since, as Kant put it, all minds work the same, they would all come out with the same answers. And critics said that it taught children that whatever they thought was correct and that there was moral relativism. Now, it does turn out that children overwhelmingly come to the same answers, but it's not because all minds work the same, but it's because they all live in the same culture, and they picked it up tacitly. Okay, one way to overcome the culture war might be to draw the values taught from the values in our laws. And, I don't know what that happened. The Endangered Species Act is supposed to promote four values. It turns out that when they write a law in this country, they have a little section where they talk about the values that are applied. And although the people who write those laws probably don't know hardly anything about values and that they cannot define these or anything, nevertheless, they're there. So it would be possible, you know, to, when somebody said, why are you teaching these values? You could say, I'm just teaching the values that are in our environmental laws. So that might work. Now, we take the example, my favorite is aesthetic value. To promote aesthetic value, economists say it must first be converted into economic terms, because aesthetic value is a non-economic term. So you have to change it. So we do this by saying aesthetic value equals travel costs. So the beauty of a national park is the cost of going there, buying tickets, buying gas, renting a motel room. And now the problem with this is that this value is being defined as what it is not, and the meaning of aesthetic value could be lost. Now you may still know what it is by tacit knowledge, but over time it could totally disappear. Now, one of my favorite books going back to high school was George Orwell's novel 1984. And then there the government was engaging in a project called Newspeak. And it was to reduce ethics down as much as you possibly could, preferably to one word. So you would say good plus good, double plus good. And then for bad, you'd have ungood plus ungood, double plus I'm good. And that's what they're trying to do with aesthetic value if it becomes a non-economic value. In a century, people could wonder why spending money to see something was called enjoying natural beauty. What were they doing in the 20th and the 21st century? Actually, aesthetic value can best be taught in terms of poetry and prose, painting, photography, natural history, geology, biology, ecology, and landscape gardening. And that's how it all became aesthetic value to begin with. It turns out that if you look, I actually have on my center website, I have a long essay with pictures, which shows that in the Middle Ages, people did not think that nature was beautiful. The church didn't want people to think that nature was beautiful, and to the degree that they were taught anything, they were taught that it was not beautiful. And gradually it evolved, quite contrary to the church's wishes, that we ended up having aesthetic value and thinking that nature was beautiful. Teaching aesthetic values this way does not promote indoctrination and moral relativity. Instead, it promotes social values and a common heritage. So, there was somebody who wrote an article in my journal, and he began it with talking about someone going to an environmental hearing and trying to talk in favor of whatever was being discussed. And the fellow would say, "I sometimes think, and I have this feeling this," and so on. And it turns out that everybody there knows what the person's talking about, but the person saying it thinks that he invented all this from scratch, because he has no idea that he's standing behind probably a 4th century tradition, which doesn't have an adequate vocabulary to present it. And so it's presented as a motivism, as "I sometimes feel," or something like that. Okay, now we get to culture war remained at the primary and secondary school level until Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980. I started my journal in 1979. At that time, Reagan appointed a philosopher, William Bennett, to be the head of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The National Endowment for the Humanities immediately cut off all funding for environmental ethics and values research and teaching. Then it renamed the Program in Science, Technology, and Human Values, calling it the Program in Science and Technology, eliminating human values and saying that no proposals that dealt with values could be considered for funding. And it turned out that I ended up eventually getting funding for a project called Environmental Ethics in the Solar System. And it was a custom of the NSF to offer to let the NEH co-sponsor. So they offered the NEH an opportunity to co-sponsor my conference, and they said it was too far out for them. And so mine was the first time that they refused to do any ethical things with the NSF. The National Science Foundation, however, was not affected because the commitment to ethics and values proved to be stronger, and they had a program called Ethics and Values in Science and Technology to kind of make Reagan happy. They changed it to the Ethics and Values Studies program under the leadership of Rochelle Hollander, who was a philosopher. And so we, for almost 2 decades, got some funding from the NSF through Rochelle Hollander. In 1982, I submitted a proposal for an Environmental Ethics Institute to the NEH, although ranked excellent or nearly excellent by 3 of the panelists, and good by 1 other, it was rejected. The reason given was that my institute might indoctrinate the participants and subvert their minds. Indoctrination was the key term, as I've already pointed out, used by the culture war critics at the primary and secondary school levels. So they were trying to bring the stuff they've been doing for nearly 200 years up to the level of universities. 1 year later, they told me I could resubmit. I resubmitted arguing that the Institute would not advocate a single position, thereby avoiding indoctrination. It was rejected by the panelists 5-1. five of them said it was the worst proposal they'd ever seen, and the other one said that it exemplified the high ideals of the NEH. And five analysts found the proposal poor. One ranked it excellent. The problem was that the Institute would present too many positions too quickly. This time the issue was relativism, the alternative criticism at the primary and secondary school level. In 1987, after George H. Bush became president, I was urged to submit a proposal to the NEH. At this time I was at the University of Georgia, and they've been doing something on religion. And so they said, you know, while we've been doing this and we have this environmentalistics program, why don't we do that? I said, I don't know if that's a good idea. But I called the NEH, and they told me that in order to have any chance, I would have to prove that the proposal would not embarrass the President of the United States. And so I chose not to submit the proposal. And in 1995, after Bill Clinton became president of the U.S., NEH attempted to get money to state humanities councils for environmental projects. I became a member of the funding panel. And the reason I became a member was because the NEH hadn't done anything on ethics so long they didn't even know anybody who knew anything about ethics. So they had to get advice from the NSF, and the NSF told them that I was a perfect person. So we gave money to state humanities programs, but then the November election came by, and the Republicans took control of the Congress and cut off all the funding for the NEH in this area. They reduced the budget of the NEH 50%, and so the NEH stopped doing ethics. The culture war opposition had moved from the executive branch to the legislative branch. In 2000, with the Democrats once again in control of the Congress, the NEH funded an environmental ethics institute in Alaska, and I was featured as the scholar of the first week of the institute. The NEH liked it so much that they told the organizers to submit a new proposal so that a second institute could be held. However, George W. Bush was elected president, and the proposal was immediately rejected. And during the next 8 years, no environmental ethics projects were funded. There have been two attempts to move beyond the relativism of values clarification introduced by the educational psychologists in the early 20th century. And I pulled these out. It's a little far here. But anyway, the easiest thing, if you become interested, is these two books, both by the same person, James Davison Hunter. This one's called The Culture War, Struggle to Define America. And it gives the history of the culture war. And then Hunter also wrote this book called The Death of Character, Moral Education in the Age Without Good or Evil. And it mimics what's going on with the culture war, although he didn't draw perfect connections between the two. But basically, he was saying what happened to ethics as a result of the culture war. So one attempt to resolve this issue is called the neoclassical approach, and the other is the communitarian approach. The neoclassical approach is on behavior, virtue ethics, not on moral reasoning and argument. Virtues are taught, not values. Ethical texts are historical writings of Aristotle, Kant, and others. And children are told stories to make moral points. And PBS started making cartoons, you know, that had little stories that were supposed to have ethical content in them. The connection to contemporary ethical issues and values is omitted because you're not supposed to talk about anything that would relate to anything contemporary. Because the children are still supposed to figure it out on their own. This position was recommended by the conservatives in the culture war, including William Bennett, who wrote the Book of Virtues and a sequel. And I bought these books and looked at them, and the book, the first book was like this thick, and it had three pages on Aristotle and Kant. That was it. So even though he said, you know, that we should focus on historical writings of Aristotle, Kant, and others, he only devoted like three pages to the whole thing. Now, the communitarian approach, this is on civic virtues and on community values. The focus is on citizenship. And I think one useful thing would be, instead of talking about ethics, you could say you're talking about citizenship. You know, and then you could go back to what I suggested, environmental laws, and say that we're trying to help people learn how to apply their environmental laws in terms of the values that you find in these laws. Historical ethical texts are less important. Consensus is sought within the community. And one day, when I was in Georgia early on, I watched the nightly news on ABC, and there was this amazing little piece in which some parents had decided that ethics needed to be taught in the schools, but they were worried what the teachers might do because, you know, they might try to impose their personal values on the students. And they thought that, I think they kind of thought they were communists anyway. And I actually have a theory about why they might think that they're communists. That there was a particular time when Stalin was around, and there was a really big push made in the Soviet Union to teach ethics. And lots of American philosophers, including John Dewey, became very interested in what they were doing. And some of them went over and studied what they were doing, and they talked about it. But when Stalin realized what they were doing, he just had them all killed. And, now, the position, consensus, solves many of the issues raised by the conservatives in the culture war. And it assumes that all values are, the culture war assumed that all values were created by individuals, does not recognize evolving social values. It therefore tries to prevent the indoctrination of one person's values on others by preventing the teaching of values altogether. This issue, however, is more theoretical than practical, because it turns out that if you get a slice of the people in the local community together and you ask them, you know, what should teachers do, it turns out that they will discover, just like that time that I saw on the nightly news, that they all agree about everything. So it's theoretical, not practical. When teachers and parents discuss what values should be taught, usually they find that they are in agreement. And that's leaving out the ones that are in transition. You know, you're not going to talk about gay marriage or something like that. But, and this approach is called the consensus value approach. And it works very well. And the consensus approach eliminates the relativism of values classification. Children are asked to invent their own ethics and values. Rather, they're asked to discover and understand their social values. And this, I would like to call, this is my term, social values clarification, which is not trying to make it, having every child, like Kant said, invent their values from scratch, and miraculously it all works out the same, but that they, it turns out that they actually know most of what these values are anyway, because they pick them up tacitly, but they don't have, you know, much of a vocabulary to discuss them. Whoops. is not relativism because consensus within the community has been sought. Although the culture war has prevented the teaching of ethics and values in schools, children continue to learn social values and ethics on their own, and there is considerable agreement. This agreement, however, is not based on Kant's claim that all minds work the same. Rather, it comes from the fact that children live in a society with common ethics and values demonstrated to them through public behavior on a daily basis. And it's also true in Kenya, except that they learn different values because they have a different social value history. What is often missing, however, is vocabulary to articulate these ethics and these values. A difficult problem at the university level is the teaching of intrinsic value to graduate students. As I mentioned earlier, I had graduate students who are totally incapable of accepting that there could be anything other than instrumental value. And I just taught a class in the fall, and one of them said, you know, you'll never get me to believe that there's anything like intrinsic value. Everything is instrumental. And others here were saying, I'm beginning to kind of get there. And most believe that value is instrumental because of economics, pragmatism, and the value-free mythos of natural sciences. And I like to say they've been inoculated against most values. And the summer before last, I was allowed to run an experiment with elementary school children and found that the children predominantly use intrinsic value arguments when defending nature. So we had this little thing. We asked them to think up a species that they wanted to be the foremost species. I can't think of exactly the part. Anyway, they were supposed to draw a picture of the species and then give why it should be the special species. And we looked at it and we discovered that their arguments were overwhelmingly intrinsic value arguments. There were only two people who gave instrumental arguments. One was they wanted the species to be the seeing eye dog, as it helped people get across the street. And also barn owls, because they ate mice in barns. And the next day, we didn't have to do anything particularly the first day. We just told them what intrinsic value was, and they went, oh yeah, right. You know, and it's like, there was a little bit of time in Germany when I was an adult German English teacher. And I discovered that if you use vocabulary of the people that persuaded to their jobs, that they could remember them much better. But if you gave them a lot of vocabulary that didn't have anything to do with their personal life, they would get all befuddled and going, why can't I remember this? And it would be obvious because it was of no importance to them at all. And basically, these children had thought that these values were important to them, but they thought it was just how they felt, emotivism. And they were happy that there actually was a real word, intrinsic value, for it. And the next day, we didn't have to tell them, you know, what intrinsic value was, because they still remembered it. And so we had each one make their presentation, and then I had drawn a thing across the middle of the board. And I wrote intrinsic value on one side, instrumental value on the other. And after they made their little presentation, they were supposed to write their argument up on the correct side of the board. And this produced what I called intrinsic value traffic jams. And there were only two items on the intrinsic, on the instrumental value side. Okay, so they understood what it was, but they just thought that it was how they felt until we told them that it was okay to value it. And teaching the word to them at an early age, I think, would avoid this positivistic emotivism. and make it easier to teach graduate students in environmental science. environmental philosophy may be too complex to be reduced to elementary school level in any intelligible way. However, it may be possible to prepare children to better understand environmental ethics when they become adults. The 200-year-old culture war makes it difficult to engage in moral education at the primary secondary school level and more recently at the university level. However, it may be possible to overcome these problems by solving the indoctrination relativism issues by just giving them the vocabulary to express themselves. It may be possible to solve this problem by seeking value consensus within the local community by tying environmental education to the social values that are promoted in our environmental laws, and also by trying to get away from consumerism, because when the economists are trying to figure out their values, they put it in dollar amounts. You know, like the famous case is how much are you willing to pay for a can of tuna if precautions have been taken not to kill dolphins. You know, and eventually we ended up with dolphin-free tuna. And, the ecologists did various things, and they learned that that if you gave them information about dolphins, you know, how dolphins died and so on, that they would come up with very different numbers than if they didn't know anything. And what the economists wanted was gut feeling. They didn't want to ruin everything with facts. And, so Sagoff says that, at one point in his book, this fellow says that, this economist says, it's really too bad that so many people just don't fill out these surveys correctly, because, he says, half of the people, you know, will say it's beyond value or something like that, and refuse to say how much more they're willing to pay for a can of tuna. You know, and they say, well, it's not an issue of how much the tuna costs. We should not kill the dolphins, you know. And so the economist said, therefore, we have no idea what they really think. And Sagoff said, well, what we know is they're trying very hard to tell you that they don't like the approach that's being taken by talking about how many more cents, you know, would be, increase for a can of tuna would be if you didn't kill the dolphins. So we could call this environmental consumership. We'd go from environmental consumership to environmental or ecological citizenship. And that's it. Did I go too long?
Okay, so Dr. Hargrove will now entertain
sort of
green.
Should be on.
Anyway, he will entertain questions and answers. Bob.
Yeah, Jamie, I'm Robert Winnicke. I went to college again.
It seems the phrase "one ought to pursue a value-free education" is somewhat oxymoronic, don't you think?
Yes.
Since if we have no values, then the value of value-free education is non-existent. Correct?
That's correct.
Why did they say
that? I didn't make that up myself.
I'm not saying that's your view, but I'm saying that those who hold that view seem to have a bit of an oxymoron problem there.
Was there a question?
Do you run into that observation of anybody else, or am I the lone prophet, the prophet of the wilderness? this or something.
No, I think it's horrible. But that's but you know, when the economists say that, well, as in Milton Friedman, that we should only talk about facts, not values, that that's the view, which is that economics should be value-free, and then the social sciences have followed in line, so that they really leave values out as well.
Well, if you consider economics in this, using the phrase political economy, that problem disappears.
Okay.
Because then you take it out of the realm of this value-free science of where it actually is, which is in the realm of politics.
Yes, but I have this view that frequently people they try to do things that fits with their values, but they figure they think they have to come up with a factual argument that's separate from it. There was this fellow who wrote a book called Among the Elephants. And you know that book? We just said, yeah, I was curious. Anyway, he was a graduate student, and he went to this park in South Africa, and he talked to all of the scientific people in the park, and the issue was the elephants were tearing down all the acacia trees, and they wanted him to do a study on whether they should kill most of the elephants to protect the trees. And in the book he says, well, none of them wanted to kill the elephants, but they wanted to have a factual argument, you know, that would protect the elephants that would be value-free. So he said that he then started looking at the back history, and he then argued that the elephants frequently knocked down all the trees, and but then the trees grew back, so this was a normal thing for the elephants to knock down the trees, so therefore they shouldn't kill the elephants. So he recommended that some of the trees, the acacia trees, have barbed wire wrapped around their trunks so that it would hurt the elephants' heads if they tried to bang the trees down.
Oh, my goodness.
And the reason the trees that were selected were the ones that cheetahs like to sleep in. Because those trees were very important for the bus tours. And also that there be a path over to this other acacia forest, so the elephants could wander over there and knock some of those down instead. and he says in his book, he's happy, you know, and everybody was happy because they didn't have to kill any elephants. But they didn't want, and I think that's what frequently happens, that, you know, when they do these studies, you know, about protecting something, frequently, you know, I forget what they call an environmental something.
Impact statement.
Right. They're mostly full of facts, but I think the ecologists are very careful, or the economists are very careful, because if they get too far out of line, people will get upset, you know, and fight with them about it. So it's basically, my view is that they, behind the scenes, they do this thing which they can do, which is do this study to get these results, but that they interpret the results in such a way that it's pretty much in line with their tacit values, which everybody else has too.
But usually when the word fact comes into play, I've found that, you know, I did work with Russell and positivists and all that, and I've found that they usually carry on the assumptions of logical atomism, which means that fact is atomic, i.e. Detached from everything else. There is no systemic
concept involved in that, which means they don't get the whole picture. Mm-hmm. And so when they talk about facts, they're not talking about the whole, they're talking about this isolated item here as opposed to that isolated item there.
We have another question over here.
Okay.
Hi.
You?
Yes. Yes, I mean, I guess I'll just kind of read through this, but so in order to identify intrinsic value, does it require that that value looks the same to everyone? Is there any sort of objectivity to it? And then if so, for the community approach, are we supposed to reach the same conclusion as the idea that as a hive, we're going to course correct to the right value to identify that right intrinsic value that we all see the same?
Well, if you go back to, for example, Aristotle says that the values in a particular society are the values that the good man holds, and that even though there may not be a particular person that you can clearly identify as being a perfect good man, that if necessary, you can have discussions, and that would be something like this consensus value thing that I was talking about. And so the values as they're presented are on the focus of the individual, which means everybody creates everything on their own from scratch without any relationship to anything. But actually, in every society, there's a long history. And people, as I've said earlier in the talk, tacitly pick most of this up. But it's a little bit fluid, but it's not, it's social values rather than individual values. And so there is a lot of agreement. But also, you know, values do change over time. For example, Aristotle knew that the values in one city-state was different than the values in another.
Do you have a question here?
Yeah, your story about the sand dollar and so forth suggests that elementary school children are more economically, tacitly persuaded or Philistine. But I would think that, you know, these Dr. Seuss book, I forget what the name of it was, but and they're more persuaded towards the fuzzy little creatures and the snail darter rather than understanding how that's going to negatively impact their father's employment. With your study with elementary school children, did that reinforce your idea that children are less likely to favor economic, ecological values?
Well, my view was that they knew these, that they had these other values, but they thought it was their personal values, and they ranked them lower because it was things that they thought that they had invented themselves. And so they thought that the economic or instrumental values were stronger because they thought that them as being more factual. So
so if you give it a name in the school,
they were much happier.
Yeah.
And basically, as I mentioned, when we did this little project about you know, picking the best species for Texas, that they nearly all gave intrinsic value arguments. So they were attuned to it, but they thought it was weaker. So by telling them that it's okay, you know. I remember I was up in the Yukon once, and they wanted me to, on the side in my talk, to say something about the draft wolf management policy of the Yukon. And it was all presented in intrinsic value terms, but then it said, but of course, there's a new idea of intrinsic value, which could be brought in, and I said, actually, intrinsic value isn't new. We've had it firmly in the history of ethics for at least 3,000 years, but it's just kind of disappeared at the beginning of the 20th century, and people stopped using it.
Sure. You've talked as if the issue is whether to address value or not, and I think, you know, it seems to me that pretty much everybody wants to teach value. And even the people with the economic view, they believe there is intrinsic value in their economic purpose, the economic methodology that they use. And so I don't really see how you get a consensus very easily. I don't think there is a consensus on value here. My question is how do you develop consensus, except on very general things like not killing, and even on that we don't have a consensus.
Well, I think that we do have consensus about killing.
Abortion, death penalty, and go on and on. There are all kinds of things you don't agree with, even on killing.
Well, it's somewhat complicated, but If you pick things where our values are changing, you know, then there's going to be a lot of controversy. But I think same-sex marriage was considered a totally bizarre thing, and it's about to become fairly normal, I think.
Another question?
Wait.
You had mentioned that, by the way, it's a very, very good talk. You had mentioned that children in Kenya had different values than children, perhaps, in the United States. And that piqued my curiosity, so I was wondering if you could give us a couple of practical ways that those values are different.
Well, they're totally... afraid of wilderness, for example, and they'd rather that
Kenya.
Yeah, and they'd prefer that there were no national parks. And Ethiopia is a good case. There was this Emperor Haile Selassie. When he died, the people celebrated and they went into the national parks and killed all the animals. And finally, Ethiopia was safe. And they don't like that. But of course, we were in the same way that wilderness was considered to be a very dangerous place for the Puritans in the beginning. But they knew that Jesus went into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, and they started doing it to see what it was like. And They got used to thinking it was pretty neat.
Another question over here?
Okay. All right. I'll get to you.
I just need some explanation on your last remark about Ethiopia, about the emperor. I didn't understand that. Can you repeat that for me, please?
It's my understanding that when the emperor died, that people rushed into the national parks and killed the animals. Are you from Ethiopia?
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
No, I didn't finish my question.
Okay.
Another question?
No, that
was not the question. I was asking the explanation of what.
Okay.
But I have a question.
Oh, you have a question?
All right. My question is, values are something that we learn. I don't think they will be taught in vacuum. In the wilderness, the person has nothing to learn from, so about the Kenyan experience, when it comes to town or to school, the kids are learning from their environment. The the environment is the first teacher for the kids. And when you grow up, like when you say keep your hands and keep your hands, when the kids are going to daycare, they'll be told to keep their hands and to themselves. They pick that and associate to what they are getting in their environment. So how could we define that these intrinsic and personal values are something that has been learned in the absence of these environmental factors?
I'm not saying that humans don't do things with the children, but it's not they're not giving an ethical vocabulary and having them do it. They're telling them to do particular things, and then they pick up that from what they're due that this is the way they're supposed to do it. But they don't think that it's based on ethical values. They think it's based on emotion that they picked up. You know, just learning the behavior. See, for nearly 200 years in this country, the teachers have been prevented from talking about ethics at the elementary school level, but they still learn a lot about ethics. They can talk about what they're supposed to do because they saw behavior, so they're learning the behavior.
Could you give an example of how ethics would be articulated appropriately? Make it tangible.
Well, probably not, but my view is if they realize that that what they're supposed to do in their society is something that's been developed over generations of time, thousands of years, that then they will be able to appreciate it more than if they just think it's something that they thought up all on their own, out of the blue. And
we have one last question. Sorry. they want us out of here.
Okay. I really found your explanation of emotive ethics to be really interesting. And just to set up the question, Gen Y and millennials grew up with Star Wars.
Trust your feelings,
right? But the baby boomers and the greatest generation were before that. So what I'm wondering is, have you seen, is it generational thing with emotive ethics? Is it the younger people? Or have you seen emotive ethics also in the baby boomers and the greatest generation?
Oh. Well, since I think that the factors that have been going on for almost 200 years, I think that it's mostly been emotivism.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I have one comment. I did a talk here on the